Welcome to Rising Stars, where Miriam Knight, publisher of New Consciousness Review, interviews exciting new voices in the world of progressive and transformational books, films, and ideas, who offer intriguing perspectives on life, the universe, and everything in between. Join us as we celebrate the conscious awakening and explore many expressions of consciousness in action.
I am Miriam Knight, and my guest today is Daniel Pinchbeck. Daniel is the founder of the think tank, Center for Planetary Culture, which produced the Regenerative Society Wiki, and his essays and articles have been featured in the New York Times Magazine, Esquire, Rolling Stone, Art Forum, the New York Times Book Review, The Village Voice, and Dazed and Confused. Don't we all feel like that sometimes? He is the star of the 2010 documentary, 2012, A Time for Change, directed by Hawa Morim. And his books include Breaking Open the Head and 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. This was a New York Times bestseller, and it earned him a spot on the Colbert Report. Now, his new book about social and ecological crises threatening the future of life on Earth, no less, is called How Soon Is Now, and I am most pleased to have him with us today. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you, Miriam. Thanks for having me.
Now, you acknowledge that your progressive awakening to our profound interdependency with the planet was seriously helped by various psychedelic substances that you ingested over the years. Do you anticipate or hope that rational arguments can make a dent in the bubble of denial we're all living in to some degree, or do we all need to get high to take the high road?
Well, what I discuss in my works, going back to the first book, Breaking Open the Head, and the second book, and now the new book, is that we have a problem in that, you know, it's easy for, as human beings, for us to get locked into kind of social structures, ideologies, beliefs, kind of like we get locked into our egoic perspective, and we lose kind of our connection to maybe more like the base level reality. And I mean, I think you know, visionary plant sacraments like ayahuasca and peyote can be helpful in kind of in a sense like stripping back, you know, your preconceptions around reality, and giving you like a new view, even really changing how you see the world and how you think about reality. So in that way, especially in a time like now where we're seeing, you know, kind of very divisive ideologies and kind of, you know, people who have started to believe in all sorts of crazy things, I think that psychedelics, you know, used judiciously can be of benefit. Now, I don't necessarily think they're for everyone. It's obviously a personal decision. There's obviously, you know, legal issues and so on, you know, but there is a lot of scientific research now being done that kind of merges the rational and the intuitive in relationship to these substances. So, for instance, they gave psilocybin, which is the, you know, kind of chemical part of mushrooms, to a lot of volunteers who had never had a psychedelic experience, sane, rational people with careers and so on. And a vast preponderance of them said it was one of the most significant, most, you know, best experiences of their lives. Given psychological tests even years after the experience, they had measurable changes in how they viewed the world that were actually quite positive. So, for instance, they had a much higher score in terms of openness to new experience and so on. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think psychedelics are the answer in a sense, but I think they're a tool that can be helpful for people to kind of scrape away the sort of crust that forms on their perspective.
Well, certainly on this show, I hear from many, many people who have had either spontaneous awakenings or traumatic injuries that led to near-death experiences, and one reason or another had profound psychic openings, psychic awakenings. And it sounds like the various substances, the entheogens, really are kind of an intentional shortcut to that state. But the bottom line is that we are, what did you call your book, Breaking Open the Head? We are opening our heads and minds and hopefully our hearts to what we are doing to our lives and to our environment. And your book really is, how can I call it, really almost a compendium of the ideas that we have to wake up to, particularly our immediate crisis, our existential crisis. And whatever it takes to do it, you know, by God, we better do it. Now, what was your intention in writing this book?
Well, I guess, like, for me, writing a book comes out of almost like a how can I say, a sense of kind of, you know, urgency and a certain maybe even level of anxiety where, like, there's some investigation that I find really significant. And then I'm, you know, I've been a big reader, so I start to look through the culture and try to find kind of books that represent that idea. And when I can't find the sort of text that kind of integrates the material in the way that I think is necessary, I feel that it's then kind of my responsibility to do it, you know. So each book has kind of answered a set of questions that were raised for me. And this new book, you know, I'd written this book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, that you mentioned, which really looked at these indigenous ways of thinking about the future and our time, the nature of reality. And I was like, okay, well, if we are in this time of great transformation, what's on the other side of that? Like, how would we have to kind of redirect or reinvent our society, our social systems, and our technological systems to be in harmony with the Earth, you know, which obviously would be a better situation. And so that led me to thinkers like Buckminster Fuller and all sorts of approaches to try to think about it like systemically and holistically, you know, because I think it's pretty obvious that we have a sickness right now affecting us at a very deep level. And it's not going to be something that we can just kind of reform our way out of it. And in a way, it feels like our political and economic systems have developed a kind of like rigor mortis. They're becoming more and more rigidified and calcified. And so we need a new way of understanding our world and what our possibilities are. So that's where I felt this book was really necessary.
Russell Brand called it a blueprint for the future. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, I mean, the book does two things. I mean, on the one hand, it looks at our systems, you know, our situation, as I said, sort of systemically, almost from a biological point of view, from the vantage point of like evolutionary biology, kind of saying that, like, you know, we think that we're separate from nature. Maybe actually we're still very much part of nature, and we're almost on the, you know, we're not really understanding that our species as a whole is a kind of superorganism that is in a symbiotic relationship with the ecology of the Earth as a whole system. And, you know, we're making these massive geological effects on the Earth's surface and atmosphere and so on, but we're not really kind of cognizant of what that means or how we're doing it or whatever. So on the one hand, we have to understand the system, and then we have to think about the solutions. And so, yeah, I mean, the blueprint for the future is the solution set that I propose. And admittedly, it's very, very radical, and for a lot of people, their first response may be like, you know, shock or you know, maybe they'll want to disagree. For instance, I think that, you know, there's profound problems with our money system. And we actually have to think about different ways that we could exchange value that aren't going to keep forcing unsustainable growth and development and, you know, drain the Earth's remaining, you know, depleted resources and so on. You know, our governments were basically, the templates for them were formed in the 18th century when we didn't have the internet, when things moved a lot slower. And now they're kind of, these systems that we're living in that were created a while back are kind of obstructing the potential we have for progress.
Well, I was really impressed by the sense of urgency that you managed to convey in the book, which I think most politicians and the vast majority of us are not really plugged into how dire our situation is. I mean, you talk about the absolutely horrifying consequences to the planet of a rise of even 2 degrees of annual average temperature. And it doesn't matter whether it is being caused by us or simply a natural phenomenon. It's still something we have to deal with. And
I just want to jump in and say that I feel this doubt about whether humans are causing climate change is a real problem. You have a vast preponderance of the world's scientists who agree. And, they really know that, like, for instance, we now have 400 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. And the last time we had this level, the sea levels were 100 feet more higher and temperatures were 4 degrees Celsius warmer. So, and we know that we're putting something like a million tons of CO2 into the atmosphere every hour. We know that, for instance, it's causing ocean acidification because the oceans are absorbing a huge amount of this excess industrial CO2. And that's leading to things like the breakdown of the coral reefs and so on. It's unfortunate that, on the one hand, there's kind of right-wing propaganda and disinformation. Then also there's kind of like on the new age spiritual kind of occult side of things, there's also this weird disbelief that we're actually doing this. But the scientific evidence is really strong. Now, I don't think it helps to be in a state of panic or anxiety or crisis. I mean, I think we have to recognize that we actually still don't know very much. I mean, our knowledge is quite new. And, if we look at the world, it's an incredibly miraculous situation that we're here at all. I mean, we're 10 trillion, I hear music starting. Am I going too long?
No, just finish the thought.
That we don't know what we're possible of. I mean, we're these right. Vast colonies of microorganisms on this tiny rock spinning around a fireball, we may really only be at the beginning of understanding what our possibilities are.
Right.
Your conscious lifestyle on steroids. Om Times Radio. IOM FM.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Hi everyone, this is Shay Parker, the host of Best of the Best, which airs live right here on IOM Radio every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern and 5 p.m. Pacific. I'm super excited to bring you expert guest hosts, spiritual discussions, free psychic readings, and so much more. I can promise that you will not want to miss this one-of-a-kind, fun, yet touching, down-to-earth show. Join us every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Pacific on OTRFM. This is Shay Parker, and I can't wait to see you there.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family, and then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Daniel Pinchbeck about his new book, How Soon Is Now? So we were talking about climate change and what can we do about it, Daniel?
Well, there's a lot we actually could be doing about it. I mean, we have to think about it obviously there's an individual level, but then really to bring about the types of massive scale of change that we need, it's going to require something like a collective mobilization. Some people, I think quite rightly, are pointing towards actually that we do have this tremendous capacity to mobilize when the need is urgent enough. And a great example of that, of course, was the U.S. in World War II, where after Pearl Harbor, I think it was in about 3 months, we retooled all of our factories for wartime production, and we put a massive tax. I think the wealthiest people were taxed at 94% or something, with all of the capital and resources kind of pouring into this war effort. And then, you know, a strange thing about times like that, of times of crisis and mobilization, is that people actually don't mind them. In fact, often they remember them afterwards as like really amazing and positive times, you know, where people really came together and had a unity of intention, you know. So, I mean, it's, you know, of course we're in this kind of bizarre circumstance at the moment where we've just elected, you know, a climate denier as president, you know, who's appointing, you know, one of the worst companies in terms of its impact on the climate as you know, the CEO of it as Secretary of State. So it feels like we're in a moment of rollback. I mean, I guess we are, but hopefully that is just a prelude, or maybe that's a necessary contraction, you know, before we really begin to reckon with our actual situation and make the types of changes that are necessary. Now, in terms of those changes, what I look at in the book are kind of the technical aspects of them, you know, are areas such as energy, industry, and agriculture, maybe being the biggest three. And we do know that we could, you know, shift to a renewable energy system. I mean, at the moment, they're talking about 50 years or 100 years. But once again, if we had that kind of wartime mobilization, you know, we could theoretically do it in much less time, in a decade. You know, that would include things like, solar energy, you know, storage units, distributed energy grids. You know, really people would be able to make their own power and feed it back to the grid. Agriculture, industrial farming is a main contributor to global warming and CO2. We could shift to regenerative agriculture, no-till agriculture, organic permaculture practices that actually can produce higher yields than industrial farming, and also they replenish topsoil rather than depleting the topsoil. One thing that would probably be necessary would be a shift away from meat eating as a major staple of the diet. Meat eating would have to become something that people only did very occasionally, if at all. And, you know, because something like, you know, it's estimated something like 30% of CO2 emissions are related to factory farms and meat eating. And it's also the soybeans that we're creating for cattle leads to a lot of deforestation around the world, which is another big issue because the forests produce 20% or something of the oxygen that we breathe. So we would have to go to a renewable energy system, distributed energy. We'd have to go to regenerative agriculture, reforest the planet, you know, as much as we could. And then we would also have to rethink our industrial systems so that they use kind of cradle-to-cradle practices. This is an idea from a thinker called William McDonoghue. You know, so, you know, you would be thinking in terms of systems that are reusable, can be fixed and so on. You know, so at the moment we get these electronic gadgets and then they're outmoded or they break and we throw them out. We really would have to have corporations would have to put the energy into creating, you know, gadgets that are, you know, are built on components that can be replaced and recycled and so on. And then in terms of the political economic system, it would be a model more of a sort of local decentralized communities that are connected bioregionally, and then a sort of planetary framework for a type of global direct democracy. And in theory, that could actually be done using the internet, potentially using this new system called blockchain, which has been developed over the last decades.
What's it called?
The blockchain. The blockchain. It's actually the basis for Bitcoin. It's a ledger system where every kind of exchange is accountable. So it's sort of a transparent ledger system. So does it allow for the kind of obstructions and hidden kind of transactions that now are part of our global financial system?
I must say that there were so many references in your book that I underline and dog-eared to go and check on later, because it sounds like there's so much being done around the world of a very positive nature that we would love to expand that kind of thinking. But that leads us to the underlying revolution in thinking that you talk about in your book. It's moving into a different values system. You quote Vinanda Shiva as saying that some things should not be tradable, like water and biodiversity are too valuable, and to turn toxic waste and greenhouse gases into tradable commodities ensures that they will continue to be produced. I think that the basic point in your book is that monetary value is the only yardstick we used with our capitalist mindset, and we need to get back to real values. What is the way that we can do that? What will give us that shift? You talk about an initiation. We still need to get into the mindset that will allow for that.
Yeah.
Short of drugs, how do we do that?
Well, I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, my book, and there's also many other books, you know, that on similar themes can help people, you know, go through the sort of, I mean, there is a rational and logical process where you have to, you know, reckon with the fact that, you know, unfortunately, the system that, you know, is now running the world is, you know, really having this destructive impact on our on the ecology that we rely upon, you know, for our existence. And then think about the options, you know. And so, for instance, in the book, I talk about, you know, different ways, you know, everything, you know, like things like, you know, money is something that we've designed so that it operates in a certain way. You know, we've designed it so that it can be hoarded, so that it accumulates, so somebody can have a vast amount of it while somebody else doesn't have any of it. You know, we could, for instance, have a different way of exchanging value where, you know, energy moves through the system more like energy does through the human body. Like, you don't have your cells hoarding a lot of energy and depriving other cells of energy. You don't have your organs, you know, kind of invading each other to steal their resources or whatever. You know, I think we have, once again, if we take this model of looking at ourselves as a planetary superorganism or as a, you know, as a human family, as one extended family, then we can begin to, you know, model and design new systems that really will allow us to thrive collectively, you know, far into the future.
In a perverse way, it's possible that the new administration in Washington and the people that are being brought in may make the situation so acute that it will capture our attention, kind of like what you called an initiation experience. Do you think that's possible?
I totally think that's possible. In fact, you know, that's kind of my that would be like my big hope, and it would be totally in alignment with everything that the book talks about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the fact is that, you know, under, you know, the neoliberal regime of Obama and Clinton, which was more of kind of like a soft power regime, you know, all of this stuff was still happening. I mean, you know, Hillary was a big supporter of fracking. You know, Obama supported these, you know, Middle Eastern wars and, you know, kind of, you know, all this negative stuff was going on. But there was a sort of overarching ideology of, like, you know, identity politics and liberalism and so on. So it kind of hid, you know, the fact that wealth inequality was getting worse and the ecology was going to hell. So now the situation has reached this extreme where we have to face it, you know.
Yeah. No more head in the sand. And if the weather that we're experiencing now isn't an indication that something real is happening, I don't know what is. I mean, the weather is absolutely insane.
Yeah, I mean, the weather is berserk. I mean, it's not even cold. You could probably walk around in a T-shirt today in late January in New York. Usually, and, you know, it's been raining here, but normally it's freezing with snow everywhere. So, yes, we've definitely, you know, impacted the climate. And we have to realize that, you know, there's levels of things that we've, you know, kind of feedback loops that we've engaged that we're probably not going to be able to interrupt. Like, we're probably not going to be able to stop, you know, sea level rise of something like, you know, could be 10 meters or even 100 feet, which is going to inundate ultimately a lot of the coastal cities. And of course, that in a way is a very sad thought. I mean, maybe we'll get lucky and we'll figure out some incredible machine that sucks carbon from the atmosphere. But even then, it seems like the icebergs have already started to crack apart and the glaciers are melting and everything. It's going to be hard to stop that. But, you know, that could also be, once again, we're such an ingenious species. We have such capacity to build and to create, you know, and even if we lost 100 feet, you know, that would only be 5% of the Earth's landmass. There would still be plenty of room for people to create new cities, to live together harmoniously and so on. We just have to realize that the future is going to be a lot for us to deal with, and we have to kind of get prepared, you know, by, I think, going through this sort of self-initiation and the spiritual awakening now rather than later.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we tend to do is to expect that technology will fix it sufficiently that we can just continue with business as usual. How do we get the message across? Or do you think Mother Nature is going to get her message across that ain't going to happen?
Yeah, well, you know, we've definitely, you know, and also, once again, we have to see, I look at everything as an evolutionary process. And, you know, I think we can, if we take that sort of systemic viewpoint, we get away from the question of like, oh, good or bad or guilty or shame or whatever. I mean, you know, capitalism was an incredibly, you know, powerful force that has led to tremendous amounts of innovation. You know, and a lot of it is also quite positive. And we could never have imagined even 100 years ago the kinds of impacts that we were having, you know, on the planet. You know, and so, you know, we've had a kind of naive faith in technology and progress. So, like, plastics, obviously, in a way, are incredible. They've allowed us to create all these things. We didn't think 80 years ago they would pollute every ecosystem on the planet and cause massive amounts of cancers. And, you know, birds are, you know, 3,000, you know, 6,000 miles away in the ocean or full of plastic. And so we have to recognize now in the future that we can design more in relationship or in alignment with nature systems, you know, but that also requires new technologies and new approaches to technology. Like, we could make, mm-hmm. you know, biodegradable, compostable plastics that feed back positively into the ecosystems and so on.
Right. Well, we're going into our next break, and we're speaking with Daniel Pinchbeck about his book, How Soon Is Now. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Grab a cup of tea or a glass of wine and tune in for Inspired Conversations with publisher Linda Joy on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Linda creates sacred space for leading female luminaries, empowering authors, heart-centered female entrepreneurs, coaches, and healers. A soulful venue where guests openly share the fears and obstacles they've overcome, wisdom and lessons learned, and the personal journey that led them to the transformational work they do in the world. Inspired Conversations, to empower you on your path to authentic, soulful living.
Sparky the Fire Dog here. Make sure your family has a fire escape plan, and they practice it twice a year. One important thing to practice is get low and go. If you see or smell smoke, it's important to get low and go. Protect your family from fire. For more information, visit sparky.org.
We want to keep you, your family, and your community safer from fire. This message brought to you by the National Fire Protection Association and your local fire department. Visit sparky.org.
Welcome back. I'm Miriam Knight, speaking with Daniel Pinchbeck about his book, How Soon Is Now. Daniel, you quoted one of my heroes, having been an alumna of the University of Virginia. You write that Thomas Jefferson said it was a mistake to end the revolution, that ongoing insurrection would have been preferable. This was in the context of the different protest movements around the world and throughout history. What were you trying to point out by quoting Jefferson?
What was I trying to point out?
Well, expand on that.
I mean, basically, the founding fathers, some of them anyway, the ones that I kind of identify with, I guess, were very aware that, you know, liberty was not something that could just be, you know, put into a piece of paper and then preserved forever. You know, it was something that people had to dedicate, you know, ongoingly dedicate their lives to. And, so he became concerned when he realized that the townships, which had been kind of like the core kind of a nuclei for the American Revolution and had created this huge kind of upsurge of participation and desire for freedom and so on, they got kind of pulled into this kind of federal system and kind of lost their self-determination power. So he realized at the end of his life that actually they might have made a mistake with the way they, you know, kind of set up the U.S. government, and it should have been more a situation where the system would encourage, you know, kind of independence, you know, interdependence also, but, you know, people, we would have an ongoing relationship to their society. I mean, I'm not even sure the Constitution was meant to be a permanent document or whether it was meant to be something that was regularly updated. And in fact, you know, once again, if we look at the internet age, you know, we probably need to create things that are more like living documents that, you know, can be kind of open source. And I think like Iceland actually recently rewrote their constitution, and they did it through an open source process where all the citizens were engaged in that.
What I particularly like about the Iceland story that you tell in the book is that they threw out their bankers and revised their monetary system. Go Iceland.
Yeah, now, well, I mean, if we look at, you know, what happened in, you know, 2008, I mean, there's definitely some severe issues with our current financial system. I mean, the Federal Reserve is actually a private institution and, controlled by kind of the financial elites who can sort of game it, you know, in their own terms. So that even a, you know, kind of destructive episode like, you know, the mortgage crisis and meltdown impacted millions and millions of ordinary people, but a lot of the bankers, I mean, nobody got arrested, you know, a lot of them still got their bonuses, and the banks were, you know, given huge loans and so on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, once again, it seems like the system needs to be, redesigned and
getting back to Mr. Jefferson, I think the point that I took from it was pulling the power back into the local communities, of participatory democracy as opposed to voting every 4 years or every 2 years for your representatives and then just complaining about what they do in the meantime. Getting your hands dirty. It's really involving, in an ironic sense, it's very much what the Republican Party claims to be about, is a smaller footprint for government, taking power back to the individual. The Occupy movement that you describe, that you actually were quite involved in, during the height of it in Zuccotti Park, had a really good take on it. What are the best elements of self-governance that you would like to see grow and take over?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think Occupy was fascinating. And I wasn't, in fact, I wish I'd been maybe more involved in retrospect, But you know, part of people made a mistake. They're like, oh, it's just a protest movement, but actually it was very much a process movement, and the process was kind of how do we actually restore kind of living direct democracy, you know? So people who were just, you know, part of that movement were coming together every day to kind of rethink the basis of, you know, government and how people relate to each other, how systems relate to each other, and so on. So yeah, I mean, you know, we have, you know, unfortunately, you know, from an early age, people are very much indoctrinated with this idea that things have to be a certain way. And one idea is that there should be centralized control and a kind of authoritarian, strong leadership. You know, I think some of that is why people responded to Trump, you know, despite his, you know, the lies and everything, that he seemed like this strong male figure, like a patriarch or something. And yeah, I mean, I got intrigued by, for instance, tribal societies, which, you know, people have a lot of misconceptions about, but they were definitely models for resilience, you know, that were the outgrowth of thousands of years of trial and error. And they actually are very non-hierarchical for the most part. Like tribes, you know, even if a tribe has a chief or a leader, the chief was never able to just order people to go into war or whatever. The chief was more like the mediator, the listener, the holder of the wisdom, and the person that you would consult, you know, in, for all sorts of things. And in fact, if the chief's power, you know, began to become a little power mad or egotistical, it was often the elder women in the tribe, like a council of grandmothers, who would be able to cut off their authority. And so it was a very different situation, it seems, than what we normally think.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I think what we need is communities to come back together and, you know, work things out together. I mean, we've seen examples of that, like when Argentina, they had a massive crisis, financial crisis, and their money just melted down to nothing. And people actually came together. The workers took over the factories without leaders. People were meeting in local kind of congresses. And, you know, that's one thing I talk in the book about Hannah Arendt, the political philosopher. And she actually notes that this is that we have a natural political instinct that probably comes from our tribal inheritance, but the society that we're in now actually alienates us from that and kind of forfeits it, because we just assume that we're going to be like taken care of by the state. Yeah, so maybe that's an interesting way that the kind of radical ideology that I'm pointing out in the book kind of could be synthesized creatively with kind of some aspects of conservatism or right-wing thought.
Mm. Yeah, that's what occurred to me. And do you think that the communities like the one that you talked about in Portugal that are based on free love, do they have an aspect of the puzzle that would benefit the wider community?
Well, I believe so. And, you know, obviously, this is a very deep issue. And, you know, I think that we really can see in our public sphere and our political sphere and the celebrity sphere, how sexuality is this massive kind of issue that we take note of in terms of this endless litany of scandals and so on. But once again, it's not something that we think about comprehensively and systemically. Hillary Clinton's husband, Bill Clinton, you know, his sex scandals and Trump's sex scandals and Elliot Spitzer and Roger Ailes and, you know, now Pizzagate, you know, which I think is probably made up, but there's this seething undercurrent of sexuality, which is, you know, something that we sort of are going to have to address if we ever want to have a truly harmonious and peaceful human society. And some of that kind of, you know, the sort of intensity around that whole thing has to do with our current construct of monogamy and the nuclear family, which have been very much seen as like the natural form that you know, kind of human beings take. And actually, a lot of research suggests that it's a very recent phenomenon, and that we weren't really, you know, a monogamous species at all And that monogamy is actually more of an imposition that came over the last thousands of years as agriculture developed, and there were surpluses, and you had to like figure out how to maintain a surplus in a family line, you know, through patriarchal lineage or whatever. And I think we see like it's a huge thing that's happening with like Tinder and dating sites and internet porn and so on. There's this huge, you know, people have a yearning for erotic experience, and in a way, it would be better if society was designed so that people could have those experiences in a safe and secure, non-destructive way. So that's what Tamara, this community in Portugal, seeks to model. And they were German radical leftists who began to realize that these issues around love and sexuality and jealousy and possessiveness were very profoundly political issues that were making it impossible for this kind of more utopian alternative to emerge, and they kind of had to be addressed first. So they sort of separated themselves from society and developed a new model where people have kind of non-possessive relationships that are transparent, with a lot of social gatherings and social tools to help people mediate conflicts and come up, and with a tremendous degree of transparency. Like, everybody kind of knows what's happening with everybody else, and even people will have like these kind of forums where they go and express all of the intricacies of their relationships with each other. So it's, for me, it was the first systemic model of an alternative that actually seems to work and to make people very happy.
Mm. It was absolutely fascinating. It was called Tintera again?
T-A-M-E-R-A, Tamara, Tamara.org. And the kind of philosopher who's behind it is this guy Dieter Doom, who's written a number of books that are very much worth checking out.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the signal for our final station break. We're speaking with Daniel Pinchbeck about his book, How Soon Is Now? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, your conscious lifestyle on steroids. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. Om Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single Om Times endeavor. Host your show with Om Times Radio Network.
Today, my new dad threw a barbecue.
I burnt everything.
And then we played catch.
I broke Mr. Lewis's window. And then, somehow, my hand.
My hand! And then my dad even let me drive his car.
The hospital's on the right!
It was a rough day.
It was a great day.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of kids in foster care will take you just as you are. For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Daniel Pinchbeck. Daniel, I think this gets us back to the underlying question of values. What do we value in life, and what are we willing to give up to achieve those values or to achieve real happiness and satisfaction? You were talking about this community in Portugal, Tamara. We were talking about the monetary system and its propensity to value everything, or to cause us to value everything in terms of money. There are many other examples that you give in the book about alternative human organizations, communities. Do you think that we're going to be forced in this direction? Do you think we can go to it through choice? I think many people are already doing it. What do you think are the best models or the intermediate models that will draw us in the right direction?
Intermediate models? Let's see. Yeah, I mean that's the big question, right? Like if you know, I guess what I was, you know, the way I was thinking about it for the book was like, you know, we need to know where we're going, and we need to have a shared focus, direction, intention, mission, you know, and in a way, that might be quite profoundly different. I mean, you know, as an example, think about somebody like Steve Jobs, who maybe had this idea for the iPhone, and he was like, okay, like, I want this to make this amazing thing. I see that it's possible, but it's going to require, like, you know, software and minerals and factories and hardware, and it may take 10 years to put the whole thing together, and then we'll have this amazing new thing. We think about that in terms of, you know, commercial products or gadgets. We don't think about that in terms of how we want our society to be. So for the book, I was like, okay, like I think we would prefer to have a, you know, democratically localized, participatory, decentralized you know, system where everybody was, you know, had a basic income, so nobody was tremendously anxious, and where our, you know, our yeah, the whole all the things we've been discussing. So then the question is, yeah, what are the steps to get there? And it's complicated. I mean, I think that one piece of the puzzle could be social technologies, media. I mean, we've seen things like, I mean, you know, we see how these social tools can really rapidly shift many things about how people live and how they relate with each other. You know, whether it's a new app like, you know, a dating app or something like Uber or Airbnb. Or Facebook, you know, so I guess a question would be, could there be a set of social tools that are designed to help people trust each other again, share resources, make decisions together? And actually, there have been some examples of all of these types of tools, and maybe it'll be, you know, as we go into kind of this financial and ecological crisis, as it deepens, those tools will become, you know, accessible to everybody and scale very rapidly.
What is your sense of urgency for change? What kind of tipping point do you think is upon us? Do you have a time frame?
I don't really have a time frame. I mean, you know, I think that the way of life that we have now, in terms of the resource, you know, basis of it, definitely has an expiration date of about, you know, 50 to 20 years. You know, I mean, even the UN has said that, you know, we have about you know, at the current way we're doing agriculture, 60 years of harvest left before the global topsoil is so depleted that we can't do it anymore. And we know that we're losing about 10% of the Earth's remaining biodiversity every 10 to 15 years. We're losing somewhere around like 150 or 200 species a day. So, yeah, we're definitely in the end game already. How it shakes out or when exactly, I don't really feel that makes sense for me to prognosticate, you know, but I think everyone's aware that we're in this transformational period and it's going to keep getting more intense. And either it's going to, you know, go more in the direction of authoritarianism and border control and, you know, all this kind of negative approach, or it'll be something quite different where we'll really have to, you know, kind of take a radical alternative approach to bring about the types of changes that, you know, I'm looking at and people like Buckminster Fuller and Oscar Wilde kind of envision.
Yeah, you quoted both of them with some very memorable quotes, which I can't remember, but I will have to go back and find them. So you describe options like rebuilding our cities or retrofitting our cities with urban gardens and learning to live with less, and some startling statistics on how much greenhouse gases one air flight produces, so that we should really seriously consider cutting down on air travel. I think one of the things that we want is to feel that we're all in this together. And when we see a section of our society continuing with business as usual, we feel, oh, well, if I don't, then I'm just a chump. So enforcing this we're all in this together mentality is, I think, one of the core elements of solving the crisis. Or giving us a positive future. What do you think is the role of artists in this?
Let's see.
Including writers like yourself.
I think artists, you know, could have the role of really kind of like developing the new mythology. Because once again, as humans, we're very mythological creatures. Like we create myths and cultural narratives, and we believe in those myths and cultural narratives, and then they kind of direct what we do with our time and our energy. You know, so like patriotism, for instance, is a mythological idea, right? It doesn't exist in nature. That one should be connected to one's country and feel that as like an extension of one's body or something. So now we need like a new set of mythologies to kind of replace the ones that aren't serving us anymore. And yeah, in the book I try to propose some of those, like, you know, really thinking about ourselves as kind of like cells in this planetary superorganism, or thinking about the idea that, you know, maybe we do have profound psychic abilities, you know, that I think that we do have, and that maybe, you know, one reason we've subconsciously self-created or self-willed this crisis is to force us to access our own latent greatness, our latent capacities.
Well, you certainly took on a big task in trying to wrap all of these thoughts and solutions into one book. So I applaud you for that. It's called How Soon Is Now. Tell me, do you have a website that you want to direct people to?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a howsoonisnow.info. It's the website, and you can sign up for mailing lists, and I'll put out ideas and sections of the book and so on. There's also, I can be followed on Facebook and on Twitter, all that fun stuff.
You recently launched a new social network called Woke. What is
that? Well, we haven't really launched it yet. It's sort of in development. But once again, I mean, I feel like, you know, media is a very important piece of the puzzle. And we really see with this last election that, you know, the impact of this extreme right-wing media has, you know, really pulled people into a kind of vortex of, you know, kind of the filter bubble effect and so on. So, and I think that, you know, there needs to be an alternative media hub or network that is as focused on the, you know, what we could do, on the positive solutions, on these alternatives, the kind of great vision for our future that is actually one of our whole human family coming together and you know, taking care of each other, taking care of the planet, but then also not just being, you know, kind of you know, woolly-minded about it, but actually being very brass tacks about what that looks like. How do we model our behavior? You know, what do we have to give up? What do we gain? You know, so that's kind of the idea.
So it sounds like it is encompassing much of the end part of your book, with practical solutions and links to other people who are doing positive things. Yes.
Yeah, but we will see. That's basically the idea, and hopefully it'll, you know, not just be me, but a whole chorus of voices and contributors.
When do you expect it to come online?
Oh, I don't know yet. It's still in development. But I started a company years ago called a media company called Evolver, which is actually still going strong. There's a web magazine, Reality Sandwich, and they do video teleseminars called the Evolver Learning Labs, and they have a space in New York that sells like herbal products and books, and there's a lot of events. So I feel that I now have some good experience in building this type of organization.
Well, you must let us know when it is about to launch, and we will get
absolutely. Well, hopefully you're on my email newsletter list, because I will keep pigging the world with everything I can think of that I'm involved with.
Okay, so how do you get on your email list?
Well, as I said, easiest would be to go to howsoonisnow.info. But I also have my own website for a lot of my past works and interviews and videos, which is pitchbeck.io. So those are the two good ways.
Very good. So do you have a final word for humanity listening? Final thought?
Yeah, I think that essentially we have to overcome fear to face what's happening. And once we do that, if we could go into more of a mindset of kind of this is a great opportunity and a great initiation that's going to lead to my own personal evolution, then we have a much better chance of dealing with what's happening.
Let us hope. Well, thank you, Daniel Pinchback, author of How Soon Is Now. I'm Miriam Knight for New Consciousness Review. Thank you so much for listening, and do join us next week. Many blessings. Goodbye.